Good afternoon. We'll call a committee to order. We've got a couple of vacancies, but we won't be moving on anything right away. So, but I don't want to delay the hearing. Let's go ahead. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2450. Colleagues, just by way of reminder, well, we'll get all the committee here, and then we'll talk about that. With regard to 2450, Steve Meyer is our legislative revenue office representative. And Steve, perhaps you could bring us, give us a lead in on House Bill 2450.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2450 deals with some legislation that was first passed last biennium in 2003. The legislation at that time had sunset dates put on it, effective July 1, 2005. House Bill 2450 removes two of those sunset dates for two different programs. One is for the high cost disability grant. That was new last session. And it, without legislation removing that sunset, then in 05-06 there would no longer be a high cost disability grant as part of the school distribution formula. As you recall, that grant provides funding for costs in excess of $25,000. But there was also a cap of $12 million per year to that grant. And then if the eligible costs exceeded that $12 million, the grant would be prorated. The other sunset date removed deals with the small high school supplement fund, currently $2.5 million a year. It's taken out of the school fund and put into that supplement fund. And it goes to districts with small high schools based on their average daily membership as a percent of total average daily membership for all small high schools in the state. And the school district has to have less than 8,500 weighted average daily membership to qualify. So that those are the basics then for the two things that will cease come July 1st unless sunsets are removed. So the pertinent part of the bill is at the end, Section 6. There you see the amendments to ORS 327-336 by Section 5. Sections 3 and 31 of Chapter 715, Oregon Laws 2003, are repealed. I have included then behind your bill the pertinent sections of the 03 statute from Chapter 715. So you should have those for reference. And also you have a table of numbers with your packets that shows the districts that received the high-cost disability funding based upon the 03-04 data, the first year of the program. That information is just about complete. So you can see the number of students that qualify is 1,915. The total expended for high-cost students is just about $65 million after subtracting the $25,000 per student that it's not eligible costs. The eligible costs are about $17 million. The grant, $12 million for an average for high-cost student of about $6,300. Also, in the first couple columns, you have the data on the small high school supplement fund, number of students, and then the distribution of that $2.5 million among the districts with the small high schools. What I haven't done here yet is to do a comparison with and without these two programs as part of the overall state school fund dollar use, and that will be forthcoming. And then you also have a revenue impact statement that lays out some averages by type of district for those two programs. So that's the starting point, and again, that's preliminary. I want to add some more information to the revenue impact statement, but that will give you some of the basic numbers and the number of districts involved. The there's 94 districts, about 93 or 4, something like that, for the high-cost students, and about 100 districts with small high schools. And with that, any questions that I can answer at this time?
Steve, colleagues, I just call your attention to the breakdown by schools. This form that's in your packet And Representative Tonk, you're familiar with that already. You've used those in your profession.
Mm-hmm.
Colleagues, Steve is the man to whom we turn to get this. When you want to know fiscal impacts of these various items on your school districts, feel free to contact Steve in the Legislative Revenue Office. Steve, I have a question relative to the schools. I'm looking at the schools in, for instance, Harney County, and Grant County, and Malheur County. Those are all mostly small schools, zero. But then when I look over at Coos County, I see that all but one school in Coos County is a recipient of this money. Can you maybe share with us how Coos and Curry have almost every district involved, and other counties, I guess over in Lake County, they've got $682 in the North Lake School District 14. What's the phenomenon that happens there?
Mr. Chair, I can't directly answer that. Perhaps someone that has more direct contact with school districts can, that will be testifying today.
But it's based upon available for everyone?
It's just district reports, yes.
But evidently in Coos and Curry, those smallish counties along the coast have greater transportation needs, perhaps, for
mm-hmm.
Representative Berger is recognized.
I don't want to be presumptive here or presumptuous about it, but this bill was before the Revenue Committee last session, and at issue is there are certain students who are very costly, and the students can move at will, but the districts have to take them. In other words, if a small district suddenly gets a student that's going to cost them $32,000 a year to...
Transport?
No, not transport, to educate. Yeah.
Okay.
The district absorbs that student into their district under a formula that distributes, what is it, Steve, an average of what per student under the formula?
About a little over $5,000.
Yeah. And so suddenly, if that student moved into a Harney County district, they would have to be educated under our laws. And this basically recognizes under the formula that there are those students that are very costly, and wherever they move or wherever they live, they have to be educated by the district they're in. And so this is a distribution out of the formula to those counties or those districts that are most impacted. And over time, it should change. In other words, if the student changes to another district, then the money would go with them into that new district, is my understanding of when we passed it last session. So just because they aren't there in one district this year doesn't mean they couldn't move, presumably. And one of the reasons that we wanted to look at it was to see exactly where these students did fall, because we weren't sure when we passed it.
Thank you, Representative. I guess I find it strange that on the southeastern Oregon front, there are very few, if any, of these students. The schools are not seeking the reimbursement, but from the southeast, but from the southwest, the schools are all seeking a reimbursement. I appreciate the fact that it may be that there's just more students with with disabilities living in certain parts of Oregon.
And also there's more services for students with disabilities in certain parts of Oregon.
Right.
It would be very, very difficult for a disabled student, I think, to travel the distances too. And maybe families are making some choices there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to presuppose that. This is just a distribution. But that was how it was explained when we passed it last session.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Boquist.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a question in regards to revenue impact preliminary statement. Really what we're actually saying is it says shifts $12 million, shifts $2.5 million. What we're really saying is it continues a program established 2 years ago. It's not shifting it. We would be reauthorizing a program that we're evaluating for the past 2 years.
Steve?
Is that correct?
Yes, but from the standpoint that the sunset is there.
Right, right.
It's a shift.
Okay. It's a shift, but it's
not a new shift.
It's not a new shift.
No, correct.
It's a continuing shift, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Yes. Representative Esquile, please.
Yes, I'm curious. I observed the class in Medford that was for
challenged youth, and it was funded by ESDs. Is this? I mean, please explain the difference, because the funding was, I believe, around $28,000 per student in that particular class, and
with so, disabilities.
Yes, that's correct. So I'm kind of curious on, is this an apple and an orange, or what are we doing here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the ESD costs for that high disability student can be included by the school district for the costs that are above the $25,000. Okay. ESD has its own money to spend for special education. If they are spending some of that money on a student, high cost disability student, then the dollars that that ESD spends can be added to what the school district is spending for the total amount.
Which fund draws first, Steve?
Yeah.
ESD or the...
You got to explain this a little better than that, because the way I understood it, maybe I misunderstood what they were saying, is that they were doing $28,000 per student and ESD was paying for that. They didn't even mention the school districts.
Okay.
But what I'm asking is, are we doing $28,000 through ESDs and then reimbursing the school district? That's what I'm asking.
In effect, yes.
Well,
because the high cost disability grant money is only going to school districts, not to ESDs. And perhaps the department can address that in terms of how they handle that relationship between the ESD and the school district to come up with those total costs.
Okay. We do have some public testimony, and we will be able to call upon some of the other sponsors, the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and the Oregon School Boards Association, I think, in this process. So let me go ahead and call Reg McShane up, who is Reg is the superintendent at Amity. Bless you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Alan Trusser. I'm here today representing the Oregon Small Schools Association. With me is Reg McShane, who is superintendent of schools in Amity, and we're here to testify in support of this measure, and hopefully we can answer some of the questions you may have about how this law actually affects small school districts and the children in those districts.
And I'd just like to say thank you for the opportunity to testify today and to talk a little bit about how this particular bill will affect Amity School District. But I'm also a representative on the board of the Oregon Small Schools Association, so I'm also representing that group. In answer to the question on ESDs, on the cost of high cost disability students, we do resolution some of our dollars for high cost students in life skills programs. In our district, and I'm going to use an example there, we have two students in the Amity School District. We have 830 students. We have two students that are in life skills programs. The cost to our district for those two students, one of them is $41,720. The other is $42,247 for those students.
Reg, which county is that in?
That's Yamhill.
Yamhill.
You'll look on the back there. I think the average grant was like $11,900. Our life skills program cost through the ESD is about $22,500, which is what you were talking about there. It might be $28,000 down in Southern Oregon, but that's part of we resolution those dollars through the ESD, and when we turn in a high-cost student, that would be part of that. I want to speak a little bit to the fact that, and somebody had already, Representative Berger, I think, already mentioned this, we don't have a lot of choice in high-cost students and move in. And, in fact, I think Amity School District, being a small school district close to Salem, we get students that are put into foster care, et cetera, that are definitely high-cost or high-need students that come into the district. And I think if you have a good program, you might wind up getting more students than, because that's, you know, where the state might place those. And I don't have to tell you, with revenue being the way it is, that the state has actually cut back in a lot of areas in their treatment facilities and centers, and that's being, you know, extended out into school districts. And we see that as a potential problem in the future. And a lot of the services we're talking about, we don't have on site with 830 students. I think that's key, that in a district that size, you don't have the dollars to employ some of the specialists. And that's where the ESD, thankfully, has come in for us as a school district. So on that end, I just, for a point of reference, we spend a whole lot more with our ESD and special ed than the money that they have or has been apportioned to us through that ESD funding. Meaning all of our resolution service dollars could go to cover our special ed needs, and that's not true of all districts, but I think that's true of a lot of small districts, because that's a service that we don't have enough students, the economy and numbers, to be able to do that. In talking a little bit about the small schools grant, I think that was roughly $164 last year. The first year of the grant, it was around $199 or $200, $164, I believe, the second year of the biennium. And this money is going to be vital to us, especially if that 5.0 number that the governor has projected is, you know, comes to fruit, because you guys know, and I know, the limited money resources, and we're all going to have to do our part. But for us, that's going to mean, you know, an $80,000 probably cut if you look at inflation, just in the areas that we don't have any control over. And I would point out to you that that money could be used or has been used in our district. We right now teach one period of art using artists in residence, in order to be able to offer any art in our school. We currently in our district have a music teacher that's only part-time, 0.667, which would be two-thirds time. We have a woodshop teacher that's teaching part-time in our district, and we're fortunate to have those part-time people. But as revenues go, you know, you look at programs now or where we are to make reductions, and this small high school grant, although it's not a huge amount, about $46,000 for the Amity School District, is vital to us, and I would certainly hope that you can find a way to, whether you shift or however you do it, to make that happen. I think small rural communities, just like the larger communities, but small rural communities, just because we aren't able to have the numbers, you know, to be able to have that economy, sometimes we're not able to do as well as larger districts. Now, larger districts, we're all suffering, and I wouldn't be, you know, I'd be remiss to say you could have us all come up here and the pot that's there just doesn't cover what we really need, and you guys know that as well as we do. But I would hope that there's a way that you could, you know, keep this whole for us.
Questions of Superintendent McSwain?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hass, and then Representative Boquist.
Thanks. You have 830 students. The district I represent, Beaverton, grew by 800 and some students just last year. And I just want to explore some more of this question that Representative Esquivel raised about ESDs essentially doing what seems like the same thing with respect to special education. Would it be easier for you in your school district to have ESDs do all of their special ed needs, or would it be easier for you to do it all and eliminate that administrative costs that extra layer of government is, and that way possibly freeing up more money for the woodshop teacher or the art teacher and some of those other programs that you've been cutting back on?
Well, I don't think it's feasible for us to do it all, because on our numbers, you know, if you have three or four high-cost students and try to staff something there, you know, I don't think you could. Whether or not the ESD, you know, would pick that up. Once again, you know, when we look at funding in that, you know, we look at the ESD dollars that come to us, and as part of our budget, and you look at what you fund through there, you know, whether it's printing, we don't do all of the printing, some, you know, special ed, and those things that we can get from an economy. So I'm not sure, you know, are you going to have to or be able to cut dollars and be able to do that? I'm not sure if the ESD was to take care of that. That would be wonderful, provided it wasn't going to pull out of what we're able to do. And then I want to come back to the comment you just made. You know, you're up 833 students. Based on the formula that's out there, that's roughly $5,000 a student additional dollars. I'm down, or going to be down, I think 17 students this year, somewhere between 17 and 20. That's roughly $100,000 less in my budget, you know, to go with. And I think, you know, that's the piece that's pretty hard to, you know, to deal with. If we had, you know, increasing numbers, if we weren't in a declining enrollment, and we may have that, you know, coming, but right now we don't. So that same problem on your end is a problem on revenue for us too. You know, we have to look at that. And we've made reductions. We know we have to make reductions in order to compensate when we don't have the students coming in the door. So,
and Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, I just follow up on that quickly. On the issue of ESD provision or local district provision, I certainly don't want to get into the ESD debate here today, but because of the specialists that are needed to provide appropriate services to children with disabilities, whether it's an autism specialist or an orthopedic specialist, whatever that child's IEP calls for, those specialists are not on every street corner available for a district to pick up. They are quite hard to find. And if there were no ESD tomorrow, we would have to recreate something like them in the small schools community to provide those services, because every small district in the state, A, couldn't afford to provide the specialists for their students, and secondly, they're just simply not available. So a coalition or a consortium or an ESD is necessary to get those services to children with disabilities in rural Oregon.
Mr. Chair,
follow-up, Representative.
I agree with you, Alan. We do need an ESD for Amity. We really do, because they don't have the economies of scale to hire those autism specialists. But Beaverton does have that economy of scale, and so does Portland, and we are getting into that ESD debate, but it just reared its ugly head, and we're there. And we are talking about dealing with some of the real problems that the superintendent has about cutting art classes, mm-hmm. which I think are, you know, part of an essential education. And one place to look, I think, is reasonable, is ESDs, particularly in the larger areas.
We'll certainly have an opportunity to debate that at the appropriate time. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like Representative Haas, I'll cover you here.
Thanks.
And Representative Thurl, our representative, I'd like to have the opportunity for Amity to go through and explain to me, so I understand and other members understand, the whole of the program, the system of the program here. And what I'm talking about is you expended $83,000 and some change. Is that, can you explain, is that just what your district spending? How did the ESD, and I'm not beating up the ESD, but where did the other funds come from? We'll just forget ESD. Where did the other funds come from, and are we duplicating them, and how do we come to the conclusion in your district that, you know, your actual eligible cost for $33,000 and then the prorated grant was $23,900? Because I'm new. Can you go through the system and tell me?
Well, essentially what you have before you is the total that we turned in for high-cost disability students, which is those students that are over $25,000. And I think if you look at it, it's like 2.25, I think, or 2.21 students that when they got through figuring out met that criteria that were over. That doesn't mean we have, you know, several that were under the 25,000 that aren't going to be reported here. So it's just those high-cost students that are on there. Now, when you total that up, we resolution with the ESD, for example, for those two life skills students, we resolution through the ESD for them at $22,500 apiece, I believe is what it was this last year. So that would be part of that cost that's on there. Plus, what supplemented above that would be what the district pays, because those students, for example, would require a full-time aide. That cost would not be resolution. We get billed through the ESD for that. They provide it because they run the life skills program. It happens to be housed in our district. We have one student in there, but there are several students from Yamhill County that attend that classroom there. And so the aides and other costs, transportation, whatever else, is also included in that to come up with that $42,000. And so what you have is really, you know, less than three students that meet that high disability criteria. And then I think that the amount of money you're talking there is based on the pot that was available, and then we're paid out, you know, you're paid out based on if there's you know, $100 available and there's two students there, then it's $50 a student. If it's three, it's 33, you know, and that's why you get the difference on what's, you know, what's the eligible was what was above the 75, and then the payment was based on the pot of money that was there.
Follow up.
So then, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what we're saying is you expended $84,000. Then we back out, when you say resolution, what you're talking about, we're backing out what the ESD provided you.
No, it's not backed out. No, what happened was the, you know, your special ed dollars are spent, whether they're spent resolution or district dollars. You know, that's special ed dollars that are spent. And so, no, when the dollars came back that was out of the pot, that was part of it. You didn't back that money out. It's part of what it cost to educate that student. And it was part of the resolution dollars. And we all have, every district in the state has resolution dollars based on their ADM.
Thank you.
I'm totally confused, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we'll get back to it. We're not going to limit testimony to two more minutes here. Yes, Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me try to see if I can say what I think these numbers are, and if you gentlemen would tell me if I'm right. For the students in your high-cost disability, you spent $83,000, almost $84,000. Is that correct?
Right.
The next number in this is eligible costs, subtracts $25,000 each for those two students. You got $22,500 of resolution money from your ESDs, and that didn't even cover that $25,000 for that first part.
That's right.
Then when you prorated the grant money, it dropped down to $23,900. So that's what you actually got, was $23,900. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so what you got is you got the $23,900. You got $45,000 from the ESDs in resolution money, that is at resolution services.
Mm-hmm.
And so you came up with about just around $70,000, a little under $70,000 of your $83,000, $84,000 of cost.
Yeah,
is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And I just wanted to clarify, the cost of education includes transportation in this regard as well.
Yes.
So the high cost of transportation of a student that has disabilities is going to be included in this. Okay. That's where I had originally seen this. Representative Boquist, let's do this. Let's go ahead and call up the next group of folks that want to comment on this. You folks, Reg and Alan, stay close at hand, and we'll come back to you here as we need you to bring you back. But we're going to call up Maureen Casey and Ruth Gilbrick from Willamette ESD and Salem Kaiser. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen Casey, and I'm currently the superintendent of Willamette Education Service District. And with hearings that present opportunities like this, I'd like to also explain I'm also a recovering special educator. I was a speech-language pathologist for many years and then also an educational psychologist. I served on the Legislative Special Ed Task Force and chaired the Funding, Fiscal, and Accountability Subcommittee of that task force, and it was the recommendation that came out of that task force that actually appeared before you in Senate Bill 550. And that task force report was submitted to the legislature in October 2002. And the purpose of that original bill was to refine the state school funding formula to more fairly distribute the finite limited resources there are in special education for the purpose of covering excess costs for school districts. And if students with high-need, high-cost services were evenly distributed across the state, across districts, you wouldn't need this bill. But as many of you have already mentioned today, that's not the case. And when we looked at all of the data that was available to us at that time and did an analysis, it revealed that there were distinct patterns that indicated that significant numbers of students with intensive, high-need, high-cost services tended to cluster around urban areas. Families with students with more intensive needs often locate to districts that have access to medical and social services that they're available. At the same time, though, many rural and smaller districts are also impacted with students with high needs. While they have smaller proportionate numbers, and you'll see the comparison pretty soon between what Amity just shared with you and what Salem Kaiser will share with you next, the smaller districts have smaller proportionate numbers, but the impact is equally significant because they have limited resources, not only financial, but in terms of getting those highly qualified specialists to come to the district to provide the services needed. It's an excess cost for them that is astronomical. So hence came the recommendation to create some kind of safety net, or if you will, stop loss, that would protect districts from either unexpected or disproportionate amounts of excess costs. So a small district, a student could move in the middle of the year, and to serve that student could take their entire contingency fund. But we're not just speaking about students who have had disabilities from birth. We're talking about students who are in the general ed population, go to a football game, and on the way home they get in a car accident, and they sustain traumatic brain injury. They come back to school, and they may have another 10, 15 years in the system, and they need to have access to services. We also have students that are coming back to the district after drive-by shootings or other gang violence. They come back to their local district. So we've looked at the preliminary reports and reviewed the data, and we would strongly encourage you to remove the sunset for the high-cost disabilities grant. It is a strong formula. Over time, with additional analysis of the data, the formula could be tweaked if necessary. There were 1,915 students who were eligible for claiming this time, and that turns out to be 2.7% of the approximate 71,000 students in the state who are eligible for special education. So it truly is a much lower incidence piece of the population. There aren't significant numbers of kids who would be eligible, but those who are eligible present an issue of significant excess cost for a district, and this is the way to assist those districts in meeting the needs.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Please.
Good afternoon. I'm Ruth Galbrick. I'm the Director of Student Services for Salem-Kaiser Public Schools, and I'm glad to be with you, here with you today. Statewide, the cost for special education has risen, but I was asked today to speak about the impact on Salem-Kaiser specifically. Federally, the mandate is clear that we are to serve all the students, and that explicitly includes students that require very specialized instruction. Salem-Kaiser has just under 5,000 students on IEPs, or individual education plans, who qualify and receive special ed services. Our school district, like others in Oregon, receive additional funds for special ed students for a total, when you have a second weighted formula, of $9,000 per student. For many of our disabled students, that substantially covers the costs associated with their instructional program. However, in Salem, 158 students' educational needs exceed $25,000 threshold, thereby triggering the additional financial support. The high-cost student fund calculation for 03-04 projects Salem will receive $1.6 million. The cost is $1.9. We estimate the amount to increase from 158 students to 261 in Salem for next year. I wasn't supposed to say this, but what isn't covered by the state school fund or the high-cost student fund are the 691 students that I have that cost between $9,000 and $25,000, but I digress. We're here to talk about over $25,000. Obviously, districts are being asked to meet the needs of all students, and budgets are strained with the obligation to meet the mandates. Depending on the nature and severity of the child's disability, supports may include intense adult assistance, complex and ongoing nursing services, a wide range of expensive assistive technology, transportation that's very specialized, and occupational and physical therapy. For the purposes of illustration, I'm going to talk about three of my students, and I've changed their names. Let's talk about Joe. He's an elementary autistic student in a specialized self-contained classroom. He's 8 years old in the third grade. He likes Batman, and he plays basketball. He receives services in the form of special transportation, occupational therapy, speech and language services, autism consult, and he goes to school in the summer. Then I'd like you to meet Anne. Anne costs $49,000 to educate. Anne is in middle school. She's autistic and retarded in specialized classroom. She's 12 years old, shy, sixth grade. She's a one-on-one aide that assists her 6.5 hours a day. She also rides a small bus with specialized services, has occupational therapy, speech and language services, and goes to school all year round. She's choosing to get her work done, and she's a happy student and likes coming to school. And I have Samantha. Samantha's $69,000. She's an adult student in specialized transition program. She is autistic, orthopedically impaired, vision impaired, and has seizure disorder. She's 19, and she's a one-on-one aide, 7.5 hours a day. She has a nurse that helps with seizures, disordered problems, transportation problems, occupational therapy, physical therapy, health services, orientation and mobility services, vision services, it goes on and on. She uses a Braille writer on a computer to communicate. She loves music and keeps a journal. That's just a small sample of my students, but they do go on and on. We would like you to remove the sunset. For Salem Kaiser, it would be critical.
Thank you. Questions for these two folks? Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not struggling, but I have an ESD question. It is pertinent, Mr. Chairman. Just so I'm assuming Amity is in the Willamette.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, yes, it is.
So, as example, we heard the superintendent say that of the 25,000 cap, this is the we're talking about funds above 25,000 expended in this bill. I think we heard from Amity, the superintendent of Amity, he said roughly 22,000 of that your ESD funded. Is that pretty much an average? What I'm trying to find out is across the board, does it vary from individual to individual? Are there times when DSD pays more than the $25,000 or less than $25,000? I'm trying to get a financial impact here.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, yes, it is all over the map. Sometimes it is more. That is the average cost for a student in that particular classroom. The beauty of this formula and the system is that every dollar spent on education is captured. You've heard about the database initiative. Every special education expenditure has to be reported under a certain code. And so when they look at this formula, as well as trying to capture statewide how much money is spent on special education, everything is added together. Whether the ESD provides it, the school district provides it, it's contracted, it's all added together to capture the total cost. And that also prevents any kind of duplicative funding.
Follow-up, Representative.
So then you would agree that and I don't know, you probably don't have a copy of the what committee gave us. If you looked at Amity, then the $83,967 that was spent in Amity, that's a total capture of all the costs.
Yes.
And then if we looked at any district, we could backwards plan out of that how much, and I know we're using these interesting terms, resolution, and that's common in education, but in my business practice it's not common. But what you're doing, once you add the ESD dollars back into it that come from the ESD, the district dollars, so on and so forth, we can account for all of the money And then what we're talking about in this particular bill is funds that haven't been paid by the normal dollars, either the ESD, so on and so forth.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, if the funds that the ESD and the school district collaboratively have provided to support services for that student are less than $25,000, then they may not apply for this grant. If combined they exceed $25,000, then they may apply for the grant, the difference between the in excess of $25,000.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, yes, sir.
And so generally speaking, or have you seen in an instance where we're double paying?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, no. Absolutely, positively, no.
Let me just say this, and I think I'm beginning to understand the information here as we're going along. Under the high-cost disability dollars, those dollars that they are going to only seek, a school is only going to seek reimbursement from its ESD, and would not rise to the level of $25,000, are not even reported here.
Right. Chair Butler, that's correct.
Okay. And so do we know the high-cost disability dollars that are expended, that are reimbursed through the ESD's programs? I realize it's not part of the formula that we're talking about, but you'd indicated that there's thousands of students that aren't reported here at all that we seek other funds for, the reimbursements.
And Chair Butler, it would be a similar kind of a situation. Those thousands of students that do not exceed, their services do not exceed $25,000, also represent a combined cost between ESD dollars and school district dollars. They just don't exceed $25,000.
Okay.
Can I do a follow-up on that question?
Yes, Representative Cohn.
My question is, 5% of the general fund monies go to ESDs. How much money out of that 5% are spent on special education students?
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, that would be available, but you need to go to the 20 ESDs and recoup that data.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Comp. Thank you, ladies. We'll go ahead and have encourage John Marshall and Chuck Bennett to come forward. This bill is largely at their request. Oh, okay, fine. For the record, Chuck Bennett is... is waving his arms well. He's saying, not me, not me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. I think I might be able to put some of this discussion in context, and I know Maureen and others know more about special education and the intricacies thereof than I do. But I think it's important to understand that under federal law, students with disabilities are required to be served. Mm-hmm. The federal statute says that they should be provided educational services in the least restrictive environment. So the requirement that these students receive educational services is a burden that's placed on the resident school district. It's the resident school district's responsibility to put together an IEP team, the Individualized Education Program, determine through this group of professionals involving the parents of this student the kinds of services that this student needs to be as successful as possible given their disabilities. So it's the school district's responsibility to provide those services. Once the level of services is determined for that student, then it becomes the issue of where's the money going to come from to pay for it. There are some federal dollars that will accrue to the school district under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act that will provide a portion of that expenditure. Many students maybe require an hour or two a week of speech therapy, so they're relatively low cost, low incidence, low cost. There are some students that we've had experience with in Oregon that cost several hundred thousand dollars and require a program that's not even available in the state. and it's that resident school district's responsibility, based on the recommendations of the IEP team, again involving the parents, to place that student in a program that will best meet their needs. So if you can imagine sort of two ends of the spectrum. One is the multi-disabled, a very, very expensive in an out-of-state program. The other is a student in a regular classroom that maybe just may need some a little bit of speech therapy a couple hours a week. So the services, again, are the responsibility of the resident school district. Then we get into where's the money going to come from to provide those services. Well, obviously, with a relatively low cost, the district would most likely absorb those. For some school districts, for example, that have students that require a speech therapist or some kind of physical therapy, they may not be able to afford for just a handful of students to hire and maintain that person just for those two students. So they will go to their ESD, and this is where the ESD becomes involved. A portion of the funds that are allocated to the ESD out of the state school fund, 5% of that total, 90% of those resources have to be returned to that ESD's constituent school districts in the form of services. And those services are determined through the resolutions process. And that's where the ESD and all its constituent school districts come together. The ESD, in effect, says, we have this pot of money. How do you want us to spend it on services for you school districts? And through a process whereby two-thirds of the school districts, representing a majority of the students, approve those resolutions, then those are the services that ESD will provide to those constituent school districts. Now, it may be that when the superintendents of the school districts sit down and look at the dollars that the ESD has to spend on services, they'll say, well, we've got some special ed kids here, and we believe there's an economy of scale by the ESD providing the speech therapist or the physical therapist or any other kind of specialist that may be needed to serve those students, so that the school district will agree, we want you to provide those services back to our students. Well, for some students, that physical that speech therapist at the ESD, for example, that comes in an hour a week to deal with that student will cover everything that student needs. For some students, however, that particular service from the ESD only provides a portion of the array of services that that student requires. And so the remainder then, the question is, where do the dollars come from to provide all those services to that particular student? Some of it comes from the federal government. Some of it might flow from the ESD through a particular service provided for that student. The remaining services and the cost, therefore, fall upon the school district because they are ultimately responsible. So what we're trying to get to with this particular component of the state school fund was to try to recognize those excess costs and create a way to relieve school districts of a portion of that burden of those excess costs. So I would encourage you to start off by thinking of the services that have to be provided and the fact that that's the school district's responsibility. And once they decide these are the kinds of services that, or once the IEP team decides these are the services the student requires, then the question is, where can we get those services from various sources and the dollars to find to pay for those services?
Chuck, you've mentioned, John, you've mentioned three sources here as I'm trying to list these down. You've got the school fund themselves, within the regular school funds themselves, as a potential to pay for the high-cost, high-need students. And then the next was the ESD, and then the next was the federal dollars, the IDEA money, I assume that would be, before these funds would be drawn on. So what are the mechanics? Obviously, it's the level of need. You were trying to tell us that maybe if they were calling upon the ESD, that 1 hour of ESD time might be all of that student would need of the individualized special education needs. But then I guess it becomes a little fuzzier as between the federal IDEA and the high needs grant dollars. Is there a Tell us, if you would please, the mechanics of how they choose one over the other.
I'm going to rely on Kent here if I get into trouble. Every school district with a student with disabilities receives through a sort of a complicated formula some federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act dollars. We know that the federal dollars do not provide all the resources necessary to serve those students on average. So there will be some federal dollars for that student. There will be some state dollars for that student, and then depending on the services required, they may want to rely on some form of economies of scale kinds of services from their ESD.
Okay.
Yes, Chair Butler, members of the committee. My name is Kent Hunsaker. I'm the executive director for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And I'd actually like to look at this hearing today and to really look at the whole funding formula, because when you think about the formula itself, there's various components to that. They include outside components like the small schools grant, the facilities grant, all the weighting factors of that formula. And they're put together in terms of being fair to all school districts out there and being fair to the makeup of their populations. The only two pieces of that formula that sunset are the ones that you're talking about today, which is the high-cost disability and the small high school. And I would certainly like to weigh in terms of making a case for the continuance of those pieces in terms of fairness to school districts. As you look at what these two components do for that fairness issue, number one, you've heard lots of testimony about the need to provide support for kids that are very high cost. You have kind of explored the area of, well, aren't those costs already taken care of by the ESD? Aren't they already taken care of by the federal government? The reality is that in terms of federal dollars, none of those federal dollars that are spent on these kids can be claimed as a part of the reimbursement that districts are requesting. In other words, if they're spending federal dollars, they cannot claim those as a part of their high cost. So that's separate. And that needs to be understood for sure. Chair Butler, you mentioned that our transportation costs included. They are, but as you know, the state provides 70, 80, or 90% of the transportation costs. That part cannot be included in the costs because it's already taken care of. So neither of those can be included. And when you look at Amity's request, they may have had some more transportation costs, but the state was already taking care of that 70%. They couldn't include it. They may be spending some federal dollars on those kids, but they could not include those in their request for reimbursement. In terms of fairness, I think it's critically important that both of these components stay as a part of the funding formula of the state. The high-cost disability one, because you know, of all the things that have been said to you, that we have students in this state that cost a lot of money, and they could distribute themselves so that you could have a very high-cost student in a very small district, and that burden would just be too great for that district. This is a tool in terms of fairness to be able to take that out of the equation. The small high school, we all know how difficult it is to provide programs in small high schools. There's not an economy of scale there like there is in larger schools. This $2.5 million each year of the biennium assists with small high schools so that they can provide programs for their kids. The other thing is that you need to look at is the fact that these two pieces of the formula are exactly $29 million out of the $5+ billion, whatever's going to be allocated. So in a way, they're a fairly small piece. But in another way, they're a very important piece to school districts across the state to achieve the fairness that we're talking about.
Questions of either Mr. Hunsaker or John Marshall, Representative Hass, is that correct?
Thank you. Quick question. Thank you for the overview and the perspective on the repeal. Wouldn't it be more prudent to just push the sunset date out like 4 years, 2 years, whatever, because possible changes in federal funding, technology, whatever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, as you look out, pushing that out, and I guess the same thing could be said about the facilities grant or the small schools or the other components of that. I personally would like to see them stay. We have a committee that's looking at the high-cost disability, and it could be that there's going to be a recommendation coming back to you in that arena. If you look at the distribution of the number of claims, most of the claims are in the $25,000 to $30,000 category. In other words, they're for fairly small dollars. Kids that cost $27,500, so they're requesting reimbursement for $2,500. We actually are looking at data now to try and figure out, is there a way that we could decrease the paperwork on school districts, but pretty much apportion money in a similar fashion? In other words, if you took out a third of the kids that are in that very bottom part, that would increase the reimbursement to 100% rather than what it is now, which is closer to 75%, and maybe get rid of a bunch of paperwork. And we're looking at that distribution to see if that would work. So the number, I think, could change periodically. Should it be above 25? Should it be above 27.5? Should it be above 30? Again, a group's looking at that. The Department of Ed is providing the data. We have a group of folks that's looking at that, and we hope to be able to come back with some type of a recommendation. Now, the reason I bring that up, because you're talking about should there be adjustments ongoing maybe with this, and so if you sunset it another 2 years out or another 4 years, would you be able to do that? And I think you'd be able to do it one way or the other, that we should look at all of these pieces of the fairness issue on an annual basis to see if there needs to be any adjustment to them.
Other questions from Representative Cohn?
I just, on the front page of this handout, about the background here, it has, and it's just for 1 year, it's for 2003-2004. At the first line right underneath where it says school district, it has state. Okay, so for the, because this is a high cost question here. It states that we have 1,915 students that fall into that category. And then for 1 year, instead of 25 million, it's 12 million. And then, so then the total expended of this, there's this $64,929,805. And we only, you know, where does the other $52 million come from?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Richard Berger, that's the $25,000 for each high-cost disability student that isn't eligible. So that is subtracted out of the total expended to get to eligible costs.
Right. It's still just, I just still don't understand where all the funding comes to pay for these kids. And I'm not saying that it's not a justified amount. And my first job was a special ed teacher, too. And yet it's still, the picture is still cloudy where all the funding sources come from.
So the question is, for the $65 million total expended, do we have a breakdown of which monies from the state school fund or other local monies, ESD monies, federal IDEA monies,
right.
Where did the $65 million eventually get paid from?
Yeah, I mean, did it come out of, you know, some other program in order to pay for these high-needs kids?
Let's see if Ken or John can help us with that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, as you look at the $65 million, the way I look at that is that is the total cost of the 1,915
uh-huh.
kids.
Right.
And what I believe your legislative revenue staff was saying is that you have to subtract off of that the $25,000 that's not eligible under this grant. That's what the
right.
And so that's the difference between the 64 and the 17 that's truly available,
okay.
Eligible. And then you go and say, but there's only $12 million available.
Right.
So you get 12/17 of that amount of money, which is about 70%. So the issue there is, and again, what I was saying before, the, one of the things that the committee's looking at now is there a way to move that to 100%? In other words, really make it so if you raise the bar to 27.5, maybe then the eligible costs and the grant would more align themselves. And you might not, all you might do is just get rid of a bunch of paperwork. And keep in mind that there's quite a bit of paperwork that's involved to go through and track all the costs for these kids and then turn it in. So, you know, if you're doing, and some of the folks were talking about that, if you've got a kid that costs you $25,750 and you've gone through and tracked all this paperwork to get $750, there's a question about can we take away from some of that? And I think that's a possibility that there could be a recommendation coming out of that committee to raise that bar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kopp, I think your question was, given the requirement that these dollars be spent on these students with disabilities, where does the money come from? Obviously, with limited resources, and because of the federal statute, these students with disabilities are essentially first in line for services. I mean, it is a federal mandate that they be provided with the services, educational services that are appropriate to the needs of that student, and the federal law in effect says you will provide those services regardless of the cost.
Representative, let's see, Representative, was that responsive to your?
Yes.
Please follow up.
I just had one question about the small schools definition. And because when this was first presented to us a week or so ago, the definition was the districts that qualified, and it was said that they were districts smaller than 8,500 students. And I looked that up, and there's only 14 school districts that have, you know, more than 8,500 school districts out of our 196. But then the definition here that you gave us today, I guess my question is, on the Oregon laws, if this is in the ORSs, this back up here, Chairman Butler, that any of these definitions qualify a school for small schools then?
Steve?
The 8,500 is for weighted students.
Right.
Not just ADM.
Okay, that helps.
Okay, so that's the larger number.
Right. But it has A, B, and then B subsection, and then a subsection 2 under section 29. So to apply for these funds, a district could use any of those definitions to apply for those small school funds.
So the definition is in section 29.
Right.
Sub 2.
Right.
Okay. And if that small school district has a small high school, then the section 30 tells you how much money they get.
Okay.
What share of the total $2.5 million a year they get.
Okay. But, I mean, a school district can use the definition from A or B?
In 29,
yes,
section
29. It depends on whether their small high school is a 4th grade or a 3rd grade high school.
Yeah. Well, I finally see the word or.
So at the end of 29A, it says or.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kopp, it has to be a small school district with a small high school. You could have a small school district that doesn't have a small high school.
Right. That's why I was looking for the definition there. Thank you.
And Representative Kopp, I think you were also saying the 8,500 is not very small when you look at the number of districts that fall in that
right.
category. It's like 185 of our 198 fall in that
exactly.
category. But the reality is probably the reason that was put there was for a district like Klamath County or Lincoln County that was very spread out, but might have some small high schools inside of that. And so they did set a limit. But when you get into the larger districts that are in the 20 to 30,000, they are in metropolitan areas,
yeah,
and it really doesn't apply.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you. I want to get back to the funding for the high-cost disability. And the question was brought up, where does the money come from? And my understanding is that a portion of that money is from the money that we distribute in the governor's budget, for instance, the $5 billion, is X number of dollars per student. And so anything under $25,000 that student costs, that the first $25,000, that comes from all of the other students in the school district. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brody, that's absolutely right. That has to come out of the allocation that's made partially from, well, the total pot essentially from the state school fund as well as our local revenue. Absolutely right.
And I would also add to it that this is a good way to look at the value of this particular piece, is that if you did not reapprove these two bills, then what you would be saying is that the $29 million would be better off just run through the rest of the formula and not allocating it specifically to high-cost kids or to small high schools. I think a case has been made that there is value in distributing this money in this way in terms of being fair to the districts out there.
Before I go back to Representative Boquist, if I run the math on this, 1,915 students and nearly $65 million, that comes up pretty close to about $35,000 per student. But none of that $65 million is federal money. That's all going to be from either the regular local state school fund monies or the ESD.
That's correct.
Or eventually from the high needs grant. But I mean, before that's sought for the high needs grant monies, it's got to come from the local or state school fund match or the ESD first, if the $35,000 per student is correct.
Mr. Chair, that'd be exactly right.
Okay. Representative Boquist is right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go back to Amity just because it's the example. So I want to apologize to the superintendent first off. I mean, I'm not beating up the school district. He's just the example that we started out with. My question, Mr. Chair, and I want to make sure that I understand just as an example here, now that we brought up the testimony that federal is outside of the $83,000, if you have to look on the last page of Amity, it's on there. Okay. Of the $83,000 that's out there, none of that would be federal money. That's correct?
Representative Boquist, that is correct.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
And then we would say, I think we heard that $50,000 of that is the cutoff. That's the benchmark, $25,000 and $25,000. And I believe we heard from Amity that roughly $22,000 for each student was ESD dollars. Mm-hmm. So then we're at $44,000. So then in Amity's case, they would have got $44,000 from the ESD, and then they took $6,000 out of the general school fund and pulled it away from everybody else to fund this. Is that what we're saying? As an example.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, again, I think your example for that county is exactly right on. However, I would, as you know, all ESDs don't operate the same, and so it could well be that the cost that a district pays in some ESDs is higher than the 22,500. So, that varies from ESD to ESD, and a district could be paying more than that, or it could be paying less than that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Esquivel.
And are we to conclude then that every ESD functions differently, has different financial impacts on the particular districts that they serve, and there is no conformity in the state of Oregon on 21 ESDs?
That's right. Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, to a certain degree what you say is correct. Keep in mind that the way ESDs are set up is that local districts work with them in terms of determining the best way to allocate the money. And in some cases, they choose to do that a little bit differently. I was a superintendent in Lane County for some period of time. So in that circumstance, we paid a little bit more for these special kids that were being educated at the ESD than was noted in Yamhill County. But again, that, you know, it's not significantly different. In one case it might be 22,000, the other case it might be 25,000. I mean, it's probably within some type of conformity that there's it's not real different, I'll just put it that way. But there are differences because, again, you have different groups of superintendents, different districts that are wrestling with the issue is what is the best way to spend our ESD dollars.
Follow-up?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
But, see, that is $250 million a year in ESDs. I mean, $250 million in a biennium. So it's $125 million per year. Is that correct?
Representative Esquivel, that would be correct. $125 million a year.
Well, thank you.
Ken, I have a question, and I'm going to say it about the best way that I can, and that is that because, again, when we come back to the $65 million using local school money and the state school fund regular money, And then next going to ESDs before we finally come back to the high needs grant money is and recognizing that even receiving the high needs grant money, it's only about 70 cents on the dollar. $12 million of the eligible cost of $17 million will be repaid in these grants, the successful grants. Is there any potential that a school could actually recoup more than its outlay in regular funds and ESD for a student by using these high-cost disability grants?
Chair Butler, I think that question would have to be analyzed pretty much ESD by ESD and looking at that. I think what you say could be possible. Well, you've just been given an example in Yamhill ESD where the difference is probably $5,000 or $6,000. Okay, $6,000 as you were doing your mathematics. So it could well be that there's one where the ESD provides most of that cost, and when a district makes that application, they would get back more money than they are spending. I would take that further, though, and you could say, is that bad? Because you've also been told that districts are spending money on special ed, as you know, that's huge. And if you want to take that gap that the Salem administrator talked about between the double weighting that's provided for special ed kids and that group that's between 10,000 and 25,000, that there isn't any funding for. I'll just put it this way. They're not getting rich if that happens. Well, it's a fairly small amount of money that goes into a special ed, their total special ed expenditures. That.
But if it is conceivable that
it is
had conceivable. Education service district that was Johnny on the spot right up front with those first dollars after I'm spending state school fund and local dollars, local tax dollars, that they were right there in that student's education early on with some of the very first dollars, and then at the end when I come back to seek the high needs grant money, that it is conceivable that school could have expended $35,000 of state school fund and regular tax money, local tax money, and ESD monies, most of which was ESD, and then still received back a portion of the high needs grant money to cover that student's costs, which were taken care of perhaps largely by ESD, anything over $5,000 or $6,000. But again, it's that'd be on a case by case and depending upon the policies that each ESD had as well. Let's see, Representative Riley.
Yeah, one point that I was thinking about is even if the ESD is providing $25,000 worth of services for this student, that's $25,000 that school district can't use other ESD services for.
That's correct.
Right. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have kind of a hypothetical question, but I think in accounting purposes it makes a difference. If you looked at the high cost disability dollars, which is $12 million, it's a grant of $12 million divided up,
literally on what we've heard using Amity as the model, if you doubled that number, you still would not go into the ESD dollars, generally speaking. Because we're $5 million short, $6 million short right now, mm-hmm. and we're looking at about $5,000, $6,000 per student we're short anyway. So if the school district, I guess my question is, the school district was receiving exactly double, hypothetically, then you still wouldn't be going in and for better word, I say, robbing ESD dollars. The school district would still be spending that money internally.
Exactly,
for itself.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Because they're spending the money between 10 and 25.
Right.
Okay, further questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Other folks, this is all that I had signed up to testify on behalf of the public hearing on House Bill 2450. Not seeing anyone waving their arms wildly wanting to rush forward and testify either pro or con on House Bill 2450. Colleagues, I'm not feeling really super comfortable as to where we're at, and so I'm going to seek counsel from each of the members, but particularly from my vice chairs who have been here when the 2003 legislation passed. I'd like to have an opportunity to set up some informational work groups with all six of our incoming new House members and myself. I need to be brought up to speed on the actual mechanics of how this works. So I'm going to seek after we close today. I'm going to ask my vice chairs for counsel on how that would be, but if how that will work. But if you're all amenable to that, we're going to set up some work groups and come back and actually work one-on-one, and we'll make sure that we have COSA and OSBA gone now. But you folks need to be at the table. There's John. If you could help us, we're going to need to work through the mechanics, if you would, please, on this. And I'm gonna think that that's going to look like probably about three different individual work groups. And I'm first on the list because I probably understand this less than anybody here at the dais. So with that, colleagues, if we can, and I'm seeing most of you agree that this will be a good thing, but if I could meet with my vice chairs immediately after. While we're still in a public hearing on House Bill 2450, colleagues, when you're assigned to take something to the floor, recognize that you'll have staff available to you on the floor that will answer any of the really tough questions. So not to worry. It's not as onerous as somebody been there, done that, and forgot the T-shirt. So
I forgot to tell Representative Olson that the first time out.
You already mean by that, Mr. Chair.
Well, we'll have double the staff there for you, Representative Olson, to help you next time. So I apologize for that. With that, colleagues, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2450. And is there any other business before the committee today? Hearing and seeing none, I just ask my vice chairs to please stay afterwards. We will close then the House Revenue Committee. Thank you.